Good morning. This year's Rim of the Pacific exercises features 27 countries, including China and the Philippines. Could it bring more than maritime disaster and security practice? We'll talk with Ralph Casa of the Pacific Forum CSIS. And while most parents want their kids to have tenacity to work hard, can grit really be taught? Contributing editor Neil Milner is back with research on character education. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Has life got you tied in knots? Maybe you can get untangled with the help of a contortionist. Natalie Ray is coming to Maui to offer a beginner's workshop in contortion. And when photographer Dennis Orme found Kauai, he was seduced, as so many have been before him. His new book is Seductions of Kauai, History Remembered.
That's the conversation coming up after this news.
I woke up this morning and I said, you know, instead of waiting for a good day to happen, you know, waiting around through ups and downs, you know, I just said, look.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. Yeah, nice bit of music that has some relevance to what we're going to talk about in a little bit, but also just the fact that it sounds good and makes you feel good, too.
Feeling all this pressure to have a good day now.
Oh, poor you. Poor you, Chris.
We'll try. We'll do our best, right?
We will.
With grit on our side.
Oh, very good. Nice segue. Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. And as Chris Vandercook just mentioned the word grit, well, let's talk about that for a moment. It's often defined as the resolve to work hard and postpone gratification to get a job done. It's also one of the desired outcomes of character education. But can a school really teach grit? Despite curriculum that professes to up the grit quotient, some recent research says it just can't be taught, and that has national policy implications as so many schools are adopting it. Our resident social scientist Neil Milner has had a look, and he's back now with a long view, a perspective on character education. Good morning. Welcome back.
Good morning. That sounded like a combination of Sesame Street and funk, and I suppose that kind of uplifting is really a part of this sort of soft skills that you're trying to teach kids.
Right. So can you really teach this kind of stuff? I mean, these are the things that parents say that they want. They want their kids to be able to work hard and to focus and to see desired outcomes as being worthy of the time that they need to put into them. But can that kind of real grit be taught? Or are we talking about the skills that lead to great academic performance? Is there a shade of difference there?
Well, here's the thing, and we talked about grit a little bit before. It's pretty clear that characteristics that have got lumped together in terms of grit, which are perseverance, task orientation, the willingness to postpone gratification, to work toward a goal and to stick to the goal, there's been a number of studies that have shown that those kinds of things are related to later success in life, regardless of other kinds of factors. That is, these seem to overcome some of the obstacles in other ways to academic skills, and these sorts of things seem to be effective. So we know that, but there's a difference between knowing that those are important and being able to teach them to people who don't have them. And what's happened right now is that, for reasons we'll get to later, more and more schools have attempted to teach grit, while some of the research has shown pretty clearly that grit may be good, but that you can't really teach it, and that, in fact, trying to teach it has opportunity costs. That is, it takes teachers away from things that they could do better instead of trying to teach something that they can't do.
So let's talk about some of that research. You're talking about what Grover Whitehurst of the Brookings Institution Center for Children and Families has said about this. It came out not that long ago, but a little earlier this year. As you've looked at that, what were the key points that we should know?
Here are the key points, and Whitehurst has been a skeptic about this for a while. The key points, based on some recent research, the first one, which is really pretty important, is that grit is inherited. That is, if you look at, they do classic kind of studies with twins, the difference between fraternal twins and identical twins. Long story short, this research shows that first of all, that it's an inherited trait and that home environment doesn't really make that much difference. So the first thing to say is if it's part of, let's call it personality, you can't really teach that. It's an inherited kind of factor. The second point he makes is that even places that have tried to teach us, that have had a very clear goal for character education, have not really succeeded in teaching it, but yet the academic scores and success scores have gone up. And he looks at one of the most successful charter school programs in the country, which is KIPP. And KIPP has a very strong character education thing. And the KIPP did a very careful study of this. And they showed, you know what, we didn't change character. We didn't change these kind of grit scores at all, but our academic scores went up. And
why?
Well, probably because they do other things very well. Their teachers are dedicated to task. They have very clear goals. There's a constant attempt to look at these things.
So you're talking about the modeling.
The
of
modeling.
Behavior.
Well, you're talking about the same kind of thing we talked about in another segment when we talked about how hard it is for charter schools to work and what makes them work. And some of them is this very kind of thing. The third thing that he says is if you spend your time trying to teach this, you're essentially taking teachers away from other things that they're better at and that seem to be able to do some of the same things that you're trying to get out of grit. You teach study skills, you teach other things. What's important about this is not simply an academic argument, because schools are now using the ability to teach grit as part of teacher accountability measures. That is, you know, you have these teacher evaluation things that are becoming more a mandatory part of school systems with the federal government. And there it turns out that some of them are using the ability to change grit levels as one measure of teacher accountability. And he said, that's not fair. It's not a valid measure.
Even under the Elementary and Secondary Education Act and the changes that we've seen where the states are going to get a little bit more control over all of that, there's still this push to be able to have grit included in the curriculum. But is that trying to put a different name on something that a lot of parents and schools say, you know, we've lost the ability to be able to focus and kids have fragmented attention, all those kinds of things? Is this just trying to rename it? Or are we really talking about something that's fundamentally different?
Well, you're not necessarily talking about something that's fundamentally different, but you're talking about if you're talking about trying specifically to change the grit measures, you're probably taking people away from trying to do other things that folks want. Look, the idea of grit is a very important idea. Parents love it. We all do. It's essentially teaching people to be task-oriented, to think about things in the long term and so on. The federal legislation does give the states a little bit more control. This is the recent Obama attempt to kind of lighten up on evaluation.
The ESSA.
Right, but it does require that some kind of soft skill be one of the measures that you use. It doesn't have to be grit, but the schools are adopting it because it's a way of getting at it. The political pressure is not necessarily to adopt this kind of grit education, but because it's become sort of faddish, schools have jumped on the bandwagon. And what Whitehurst research suggests is, hey, wait a second here. You're being unfair to the teachers, and you have to look for other ways to measure soft skill success, and that's where he gets into the other things about effective teaching.
So if we're looking at how you change effective teaching to be able to bring those soft skills into the academic arena without necessarily saying we're going to teach grit, and yet you have a political structure that is pushing grit because people are sort of hearkening back to the old days when you were supposed to have grit, where does this leave the majority of American schools?
It leaves them in the terrible political position that they tend to find themselves. We tend to use schools and education as a kind of receptacle for our hopes and dreams and for our anxieties. And this is not the first time. It's really, as far as I'm concerned, part of educational reform, where schools have to do certain kinds of things for political and social reasons as much as anything else. And so you have this kind of pressure to change. I mean, schools are, let's face it, schools are so much a part of the culture, it's not surprisingly that politics gets involved there. But what what I think we should learn from this kind of research is that hard, soft, whatever else, what the research suggests is that a lot of these kinds of things are very kind of concrete educational that you can do. You don't have to worry about so much changing the grittiness as much as rewarding people for doing good work, trying to teach discipline. All of those things are old-fashioned. They're teachable, but of course, on the other hand, they're very hard, or we wouldn't be where we are right now.
All right. Thanks very much.
Sure.
Nice to have you back.
Thank you.
Neil Milner is the contributing editor of our biweekly segment, The Long View. He'll be back with us in 2 weeks.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2 at 8:14. Coming up, the twists and turns of the contortionist's art. But first, your backyard quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we're calling to mind a sailing ship with a long and colorful history. It's a full-rigged, four-masted sailing ship with an iron hull, the last of its kind. It was built in Scotland in 1878 by Russell & Company in Port Glasgow, and designed to stand up to the long voyages required of a British merchantman engaged in international trade. Her maiden voyage took her to Karachi, Pakistan, and her first couple of decades were spent hauling cargo, lumber, jute, cement, and wheat from ports in Australia, California, India, New Zealand, and the British Isles. She was purchased by Captain William Matson of the Matson Navigation Company for $25,000, taken to Honolulu in 1899 and registered under the Hawaiian flag. For the next few years, newly rigged to carry passengers, she made over 60 voyages between Hilo and San Francisco, carrying both cargo and people, and then was redesigned as a fuel tanker and spent the next few decades that way until 1963. That was when she was brought to Hawaii to become a museum ship, and we'd like to know if you know what that ship is called. You can call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer, and the first one to get it right will get the T-shirt.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Matson, proud to help fund the construction of PBS Hawaii's new headquarters and broadcast facility in Matson's own Kalihi neighborhood. Learn more at matson.com/foundation.
Everyone who exercises regularly learns the value of flexibility, but the world of the contortionist is something else again. Some of their poses stretch your idea of what's humanly possible. Natalie Ray performs regularly at circuses around the country, showing off skills that she learned from one of the Mongolian masters of the art, and she says many of those skills are within our reach. She's backing that up with a beginner's workshop in contortion that she's bringing to Maui, and we talked about it.
This is a beginner contortion workshop, and it's basically open to all levels, so anyone can come, whether you can sit on your head already or you can just, you know, lift a finger. It's pretty much for all levels. I have variations for every posture and every kind of position that we're working towards. Like, we have a goal, but then along the way, there's beginner, intermediate, advanced, and in between the beginner and intermediate, there's steps that you can take. So anyone can really take the class.
But for a beginner, chances are most beginners aren't going to be nearly as flexible as they should be, right?
People surprise themselves. Sometimes people are very flexible and they didn't even know that they could push their limits that way because people mentally are scared. Contortion is a mind game sometimes, and so you want to obviously be safe, but, enable people and encourage them to go past their limits while, creating a safe environment.
And has
so
it...
sometimes people surprise themselves.
So it's been your experience that people can actually go well beyond what they might have thought, huh?
Yeah, at least half the time, and if they don't, they realize and they figure out how they can push themselves with still being safe and all that. So, and then I give them the correct techniques to further their practice when I'm not around.
Because being safe, you alluded to it a couple times, that's got to be extremely important because if you pull a muscle, you're sort of back to zero, aren't you?
Exactly, yeah, and I've done that plenty of times. So I know what it feels like to pull a muscle or seven and while just stretching. So you want to, in my workshop, I teach a lot and talk a lot about relaxing because if you're trying to stretch a strained muscle or stretch a muscle that's engaged, then you're not really stretching it. You're just kind of pushing it past something that I'm moving my hands right now. I'm very visual. So, but mostly it's just you want to relax the muscle that you're stretching before you even begin to stretch it.
And that's a little bit counterintuitive in terms of getting an exercise routine ready because you might be inclined to tense up when you're about to go for a run or something like that. But
exactly.
It's really better to relax.
That's why it's super important to stretch afterwards or even a little bit before, too.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you came to this with a body of acquired skill already as a gymnast, but you went into contortion as a specialty based on that background, yeah?
I was doing a partner acrobatic act, and I wanted to increase my flexibility to be a little different and to have kind of a specific style for my handstands and for my splits, and so I took a contortion class, and I kind of fell in love with that a little more than anything else. So I started taking classes from my Mongolian instructor, Serchma Bayamba.
Yeah.
And then I also am taking hand balancing classes from my teacher, Leslie Tipton, who studied under a Russian-style coach.
What's the Mongolian and Russian styles being dominant styles in the field of the contortionist?
Yeah, they are basically, if you go see a Cirque du Soleil show, the contortionists are either Mongolian or Russian for the most part. I mean, you'll get your token amazing American, contortionist. I know a couple who are from San Francisco, but they definitely studied under Russian and Mongolian techniques. And the two are very similar, but at the same time, they're very different. They're just one focuses on just everything's very detailed, but one focuses on something and the other focuses on something completely different. But the two, if you study both of them together, they really go hand in hand.
Now, when a contortionist performs, what does the performance consist of? A variety of different poses?
Yeah, in a fluid, with fluid transitions in and out of these poses. So I just came off of two tours, actually, one in the Midwest and New England. And I was on like a 3 foot by, 4 foot platform that was maybe 4 feet up in the air, and I was performing in a free ring circus.
Uh-huh.
And I had my act was 4.5 minutes long, and it was me, going into back bends and coming out a different way than I came in, and going into a leg scale, and then sitting, coming down and sitting on my head, and then back bending press up to into a handstand and holding different handstand positions. And then the other tour, I was on a horseback doing contortions. So that was very interesting as well.
Let me just back you up a little bit. Sitting on your head, did you say?
Yes. Yeah. So that position is called a pretzel, and basically it's when your feet are in front of you on the floor, but you're on your chin and on your chest, and if you can, like, get your butt to sit on your head, essentially.
And yeah. There was another term you used that I hadn't heard before as part of the act. I think it was before you sat on your head. But there are standard...
A leg scale.
Yeah, what is that?
It's basically you stand on one foot and you bring your straight back leg behind you, so you're in a standing split.
Uh-huh.
But your chest is up.
So you kind of put your ankle behind your head?
Yeah, you put your cap on the back of your head.
I'm somewhat flabbergasted by this, right?
I think you should come take the workshop.
Well, I'm a long way from being able to sit on my head, I'll tell you that. But how many years of training would it take to get to that very, admittedly, very advanced level?
I've been doing it for about 2.5 years now. So, but just contortion. Obviously, the gymnastics helped with the flexibility and the strength a whole bunch. But I do know people who have no background in dance or acrobatics or gymnastics, what have you, and they go into contortion just because they are naturally flexible. Or even if they're not naturally flexible, if you learn the technique correctly at an early start in your career, then you can get pretty good pretty quick, especially if you're dedicated and you train 5 days a week or, you know, even more than that for at least 3 hours.
So there's hope for us all, Natalie, sounds like.
There's hope for us all. There's hope for us all in anything that we want to do.
Natalie Ray will offer a beginner's contortion workshop at the Pole Room in Lahaina, Maui, and you can find out more about it on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Four-wheel drives, helicopters, steel towers, and satellite dishes. It takes a lot more than a silky voice to make radio. Member donors are the real backup generators for public radio stations, and Hawaii Public Radio sends our mahalo to Janine Okubo of Honolulu, Mariah Daly of Waialua, and Lucas Shaughnessy of Kailua. If listening to HPR helps you face the world, help us with the hard costs of radio. A membership form is at hawaiipublicradio.org, or you can talk to a real-life person at 955-8821 during business hours. And thanks. The forefathers liked it and wanted to see it routinely cultivated. Now they could get their wish with some pressure at the federal level for regulation of industrial hemp. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
I mean, we've seen so much pressure locally, but of course, that's just what's happened here in Hawaii. At a federal level, how much pressure is there to regulate industrial hemp and see its routine cultivation?
There's a bill moving both through the House and the Senate. They're very similar in language, and each of them are supported by Hawaii's delegation, by the way. But as you know, things in Washington move slowly at its own pace, and polarization is at a high level right now. But the bill is an Industrial Hemp Act, and basically it would move to take hemp and remove it from the Schedule I list of controlled substances. That list includes heroin and LSD and ecstasy and quaaludes. Obviously, marijuana is on that list, but marijuana and hemp are not quite the same thing. Hemp doesn't have that THC content anywhere near that marijuana does, so that's something that they are pushing for at the federal level, recognizing that you know, this is a crop. This is something that we can make money off, and we can grow it, and we can manufacture products from it.
Already you can buy products, I mean, think about soap and snacks,
sure,
and hemp milk, all kinds of things that
right.
have hemp included in them. How are those able to be distributed if we don't have any real federal legislation concerning industrial hemp and its cultivation?
By the way, about $600 million in sales in 2015 for hemp products. We can't grow the hemp here and manufacture it commercially. We have to import it. It comes from places like Europe and Asia and particularly Canada. Well, we're spending $76 million to bring that crop in here. Imagine if we could grow it here. And you mentioned Washington and Jefferson. Both of them, gentlemen farmers, both of them grew hemp at Mount Vernon and Monticello. I believe that's Jefferson's place, respectively. Hemp was grown quite a lot in a lot of places up until about the 1930s, and that's when the law changed, with a brief exception during World War II when we needed hemp fiber to fight the war. But because of this fear that somehow hemp will get you high, that it's a drug, a total misconception, hemp has not been allowed for legal growing and manufacturing purposes here.
And exactly the point that if we could grow it here and not have to import it, that might make some of these products that are a little pricey right now, maybe a little more expensive, a little less expensive and more accessible to a lot of us, too. Okay, well, there's a lot of hemptation there on the page. I just saw all the things that you have listed there, including some products that I have some familiarity with, but looks good. Thanks very much. We're going to talk to you tomorrow.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat, and he joins us every day with a reality check.
Good morning. It's 8:30, and you're tuned to The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Chris Vandercook. You can get in touch with us through our talkback line, which is 808-792-8217. Our Twitter handle is HI Conversation, and email is talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from Bank of Hawaii Private Banking, where a personal relationship manager and financial services team provide custom solutions. Learn more about Bank of Hawaii Private Banking at boh.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Nobody gets to speak without race being a factor.
On the next Radio Lab,
U.S. federal government through an act of Congress will substantially reform domestic transportation.
This is academic debate. The white world of college debate is upended
yeah.
by a team of black debaters.
Sometimes you need to duck walk on them.
Dead set on changing the rules.
It made people stop. He said, you should go down the hall because that's where Poetry Prose is held.
Join us for the next Radio Lab.
Saturday morning at 10. Support for today's programming comes from Maui Arts and Cultural Center and Mamo at the Mac, a wearable art event featuring Hawaiian design in fabric and clothing, this Saturday at 7:30 p.m. with Trunk Show at 6. MauiArts.org.
Tonight at 5, it's Bite Marks Cafe with Bert Lum and Ryan Ozawa. And Bert, it looks as if technology is coming to the aid of a broken music industry.
Well, you know, Chris, I figured you might be interested in the topic of this show. We're going to be venturing into the music industry. I don't know if it's broken per se, but I think there are a lot of new tools that bands can take advantage of.
Well, the old model is certainly pretty much out the window anyway.
What's that?
The old model is pretty much out the window.
You know, the old model of let's get a band, let's find a record label, let's, you know, have them promote our record and distribute it across the country. And
Yeah,
I think that's broken. But so what we're going to do is we're going to talk to Chaz Umamoto from Streetlight Cadence
mm-hmm.
and a fellow by the name of John Yamasato, who was with Pure Heart and then started something called High Sessions.
Mm-hmm.
And they do a lot of, you know, I think both, well, obviously both are young and both are using some of the tools like the internet to get their music out there. And we'd like to learn whether they have been successful and what kinds of lessons have they learned.
Well, certainly Streetlight is kind of a whole new paradigm for how to create a career, it would seem.
Well, you know, Chris, I hope you call in and listen to our show.
Of
so
course.
Maybe you can ask some of those really pointed questions.
See?
I'm curious as much as you are. Like, are they successful? I mean, are they having to do anything new or different, or, you know, is it still pretty much, you know, the music or the musician's grind? You know, you got to go out and play gigs.
Well, you certainly, there's no getting around that. It helps to have a sense of adventure, too.
That's true. And you have to be young at heart, right?
If not actually young.
So we'll talk to them and we'll learn some lessons and maybe we'll get all inspired.
Oh, no doubt. Thanks a lot.
Sure thing.
That's Bite Marks Cafe tonight at 5 p.m.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, striving to increase awareness and treatment of kidney diseases affecting 1 in 7 Hawaii residents. Learn more at kidneyhi.org.
Next week, the biannual International Rim of the Pacific exercises begin in waters around Hawaii and Southern California. Included in the 27 participating countries are China and the Philippines, countries at odds in the contentious region of the South China Sea. That ongoing conflict over authority in the area has developed substantially since the last RIMPAC, and we wanted to know what impact that might have on the maritime exercises this year. We called Ralph Casa, president of the Pacific Forum CSIS, who joins us now. Welcome back.
Well, thank you, Beth. Good to be here.
As we talk about the South China Sea, there's been so much posturing, so many points and counterpoints and finger pointing and exercises. Do you see this in any way coloring this year's RIMPAC any differently from what we saw 2 years ago?
Well, it will certainly increase the press coverage and will increase the temperature level of those that complain about Chinese participation. But I think at the end of the day, this is focused on naval cooperation, and the navies are here to cooperate with one another.
It's still an exercise where security is an issue and learning how to respond to security issues as well as potential disasters. When you have countries that are needling each other and looking at each other with a bit of a fisheye, is it possible for them to be able to coordinate and cooperate in such a way during these exercises that would be meaningful and genuine without having, you know, some of the others slip in?
No, I think that's a very good concern, but I think it's very important to understand this is a multidimensional exercise. There are things that have to do with humanitarian assistance, disaster relief, submarine rescue operations. There's also some combat and some operational activities. The Chinese will not be participating in the latter. In fact, they are legislatively prohibited from participating in the latter. For instance, there'll be landing exercises on the West Coast. There'll be no Chinese ships involved in that. So they've made an effort. They have to make an effort to sort of separate the security aspects of the exercise from the humanitarian. Now, will the Chinese be able to watch and see how good we are? Yes, and that's not a bad thing for them to see.
By design, that seems to be inherent in the whole exercise, is to see what the other guy, in this case us, may be doing.
Right.
You've just come back from Beijing. As you've been hearing a lot of the conversation about the South China Sea, as well as seeing a lot of the coverage there in China, and even just seeing some of the material that's come through today from the People's Daily, but as the finger sort of being pointed back at the United States,
yeah,
is, you know, hegemony, it's
yeah,
look at the Americas, and that the Americans are being really disingenuous in their supposed call for neutrality and all of this. We're not being very neutral in it. How has that conversation been developed as you've heard it while you were in Beijing?
Well, it's very interesting. You know, the Chinese are very smart, but they have not yet mastered the concept of cause and effect, at least not when China is the cause. So obviously, none of the tensions in the South China Sea are caused by Chinese activities, so they must find another reason. So when in doubt, blame the United States, and they certainly have. You know, somehow or other, we are emboldening the Philippines and Vietnam and others to challenge China. It's not Chinese actions. So there's a lot of kabuki going on. There's a lot of name-calling on both sides. But there is still a concerted effort to make sure that there's no crisis, that there's no accident. I worry about accidents, but I don't worry about either side deciding to do an in-your-face operation that would, you know, be a deliberate act of conflict. Nobody wants to have that.
In turning a blind eye, though, to their own actions, there are other ramifications that the Chinese clearly are going to have to deal with. I mean, there are environmental concerns. We've heard from scientists who are calling on other scientists within the broader scientific community to focus on this more. But also there seems to be more pressure for, you know, the United States to make sure that eye gets opened a little bit by showing up a little bit more often. Is that something that you really feel is in the Americans' best interest, to be able to have, you know, more ships go by and take a look at really what's happening in the South China Sea, or is that destructive?
I think it gets counterproductive at a point. The U.S. for years has been conducting freedom of navigation operations. And we used to do it, what, once every 3 months, once every 6 months, just to make a point. And that's all you have to do to make a point. Now, if we haven't done one in every 48 hours, there's 700 questions from the press. When's the next one? When's the next one? That is not helpful. I will tell you that in private conversations with the Chinese, what they've told me is, look, we understand you're going to continue to do freedom of navigation operations, but could you please do it quietly? If you keep broadcasting it, then we have to keep complaining about it. And that just creates this aura of tension where none needs to exist. In addition to that, you know, every time you conduct a freedom of navigation operation, you're affecting the lives of thousands of U.S. sailors. And if you want to do carrier operations, everyone wants to send a carrier everywhere. This is, you know, a carrier is a city of 6,000 people, and then there's another dozen ships that go with it. Every time you're sailing one into the South China Sea, first of all, you're increasing the op tempo, you're increasing their time away from home, and you're taking away from their ability to do other things. Plus, you don't want to send carriers into shallow waters full of reefs. This could prove to be embarrassing. So the people calling for, you know, daily freedom of navigation operations, and we need to do this once a week, that's ridiculous. The Chinese understand. They've gotten the word. Other countries have gotten the word. So we need to be a little bit more realistic and not be reacting to press demands or Congress's demands during an election year, but actually do things that make strategic sense for the United States.
So how do you get the press to understand some of those really cogent reasons that you gave as to why this is not a good idea, and this is just whipping into a frenzy a situation that is already tense and doesn't need any more tension added to it?
I think you have to come on NPR and talk to people about that. Hopefully we've just educated a couple of people, but I think it has to be repeated over and over again. You know, the problem, quite frankly, with all due respect to our press, today they're covering RIMPAC. 2 days from now they're covering, you know, the latest silly thing that Donald Trump has said, and 3 weeks from now they're covering a mass shooting somewhere. So we're not really getting educated people who are focused on security issues who are reporting on these things, and I think it puts an extra burden on those of us who can at least spell the word security to try to explain these things to people and hopefully have them listen.
In listening, someone has to be, first of all, open to listening. That
right.
seems to be an issue, too, where you have people who are being driven by the emotional, you know, the very persuasive words like of Donald Trump trying to make America great again and seeing that it's asserting its power in certain ways that you say are not productive. So isn't there sort of going to be a wall there anyway where with a lot of people and, unfortunately, people who are going to, you know, pander to them?
Yeah, I wish you hadn't mentioned a wall. That's another issue. But no, I think it's true. And you know, politics is hard in a democracy any year. It's particularly hard foreign policy during an election year. And, you know, we have to sort of understand that, but we have to be thinking about the impact. I think politicians have a responsibility to think about the impact of their words, not just at home and not just with voters, but internationally as well. And we need to be calling people's attention to that and holding their feet to the fire on that.
As we've called attention to RIMPAC, just to wind up our conversation, yeah. Not a whole lot different that you're going to see this year, even with everything else that we've talked about?
No, I think the basic effort is still there, focusing on humanitarian cooperation. A few more countries, a few more ships, but essentially this is aimed at Navy cooperation, and that's a good thing.
All right. Thanks very much for joining us. Always good to have you here.
It's my pleasure. Beth Ann, thanks.
Ralph Kosse is president of the Pacific Forum CSIS in Honolulu and senior editor of the forum's quarterly electronic journal, Comparative Connections. He is the primary U.S. representative and former international co-chair of the ASEAN Regional Forum Experts and Eminent Persons Group, as well as the founding member and current co-chair of the Multinational Council for Security Cooperation in the Asia Pacific.
In today's Backyard Quiz, a sailing vessel that saw service as a British merchantman and as a fuel tanker, built in Scotland at the end of the 19th century to stand up to the rigors of long ocean voyages. In 1963, she was bought to Hawaii as a museum ship docked in Honolulu Harbor. In 1973, she was entered into the National Register of Historic Places, and in 1989, she was declared a U.S. National Historic Landmark. Despite her rich history, the vintage sailing vessel has fallen into disrepair, and last week, the State Department of Transportation revoked a permit that allowed it to moor at Honolulu's Pier 7, saying its condition poses a safety and security risk to harbor users. Its owners, a nonprofit dedicated to historic preservation, are disputing the order. Bruce McEwen, president of the organization, says Falls of Clyde is a symbol of decades, if not a century, of sailing history in a maritime state. As a national historic landmark, she's definitely worth preserving. And that's the name we were looking for, the Falls of Clyde.
And Brad Smith called us from Kailua Kona to be able to let us know that he knew the answer. He'll be receiving the T-shirt. And if you have a quiz question for us, send it in. It can be about all things Hawaii or anything that's concerned with Hawaii, and we'd love to have your submission. All you have to do is send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Dennis Orme has been a photographer all his life, so he understands that every image has a story behind it. For his new book about his Kauai home, those stories and those images are brought together to evoke the island's colorful past. His book is Seductions of Kauai, History Remembered, and he's on the line with us this morning. Good morning, Dennis.
Good morning, and thanks for the opportunity.
Sure. Well, you've made some decisions about what you consider to be the significant events and kind of moving, pivoting points of Kauai history, yeah?
Yeah. I did a lot of research. I was fortunate enough to get onto the Pacific Missile Range facility. I belong to the Historical Society, the Kauai Museum. And then I've had a lot of people who were born on the island who have sort of helped me, and that's sort of the Haraguchi family who originally started off in the 1850s with fields and then converted in the 1920s to taro fields. So some wonderful sources of information. And so what I've done is capture a chronological history of the island. Many people have sort of told it to me, starting way back with prehistoric times, the Mahalapu Cave, the Menahuni Ditch, and some of these significant Limahuli Gardens and things like that. And then, of course, you move through and you've got the whole chapter in the Hawaiian Islands and Kauai in particular, the sugarcane industry, which came to prominence around the time of the American Civil War. It started before that on Kauai, 1855, but it came to prominence with the American Civil War and very significant part of the economy through to 2010.
Sure. How do you go about illustrating that, Dennis?
So what I've done is I've captured modern-day photographs of the old sugar mills that were abandoned, you know, prior to 2010. Mm-hmm. I've got, you know, quite a lot of rich history on the sugar mills, and then, of course, I swapped over and then I looked at the religious history going back to 1834 when there was a lot of attempts by missionaries to convert Hawaiians to Christianity. And so there's a lot of churches and rich history on those churches on the island. And then sort of coming forward, there's the pineapple industry, again, which was very, very significant to the island for many, many years. And so what I've done is capture probably about 104 images in the book of the old plantation narrow gauge railways, as I said, through to the churches, even back to what I call Myrtle the Turtle. It's kind of a fun shot, but prehistorically the turtles came to the Hawaiian Islands about 10 million years ago.
So really you're able to see a lot of the evidences of the past in your present-day photography.
Oh, absolutely. So in the book itself, I've probably got about 15 photographs of different churches, and probably the strongest image of a church on this island for me is Lahui Lutheran Church. The Germans came to the island back in the 1880s, and they wanted to be reminded of their long voyage. So they built this Lutheran church, and it looks like a ship. So inside the church, the floor slopes. The balcony is actually the bridge of the ship. The ceiling is the upturned hull. And then, of course, the pulpit is one of the lookouts on the ship. And to me, that's one of the best landmarks on the island.
I would think so, yeah. And that's a perfect example of how history can be evoked in an image, isn't it?
Yeah, it certainly is. And, of course, you know, other things like the Hanalei Bridge. There was a bridge built across the Hanalei River. It was a wooden bridge back in the 1800s, 1895 to be exact. And then New York designed and built a bridge back in 1912. They shipped it here and had it assembled. And then, of course, that bridge was recreated in 2003. So there's a rich history of this bridge back to its original design.
I would think that your connection to the Historical Society would be extremely valuable in terms of accumulating all this. There's a lot of...
Oh, absolutely valuable. And things like the Ahukini Wharf. There used to be 11 places around the island where they picked up sugar cane and dropped off supplies. In 1898, they built the Ahukini Wharf, and that operated through to 1930. So I've got the remnants of that wharf. And, of course, then the Nawili Harbour came into being in the 1930s, and there was a big sugar silo on the top of the hill, which still exists today. So it's another way of sort of capturing the history. The Historical Society has been just a wonderful source for me.
Did you know a lot about this before you started, or did a lot of your education about the content of the book come while you were creating it?
Yeah, I've been coming here. I'm originally from New Zealand, but I spent 20 years in Houston. I started coming here around 1983. So over the years, I've sort of garnered a lot of knowledge. And then, of course, the last 2 years, I've been living on the island. And a surprising source of information for me has been, dare I say it, the security guards and the bellhops at the Marriott Resort and some of the other facilities on the island, because they were born on the island, remember a lot of these historical things. For example, most people think there's only one swing bridge on the island in Hanapepi, but there are actually four swing bridges, and security guards and people showed me where these other bridges were. So it's just been great.
What that indicates, Dennis, is that if you want to find out about the history of an area, talk to the people who live there, right?
Yes, yeah. Talk to the locals. They have the knowledge and they have the stories. A lot of the stories, of course, are still undocumented, even though the Historical Society's got some good reference points. When you start talking to families, it's really interesting what you learn from them.
Sure.
And the book itself is going to be launched next Tuesday the 28th at the Kauai Museum, and the mayor is giving a blessing over the book, so I'm absolutely humbled by that.
Well, it's an indication of the kind of interest there is in not just history, but in the kind of the things that you see around you on Kauai, right?
Yeah, and I think a lot of people, you know, they're interested in the history, but they're not interested in spending hours and hours reading history books. And so if I can capture it photographically and give some good descriptions with it, I think there's probably an audience that would prefer to see it that way rather than a lot of different printed books.
Well, anything that gets history to the people, right?
Exactly.
Thanks very much for
forgotten.
Yeah. Thanks very much for talking with us, Dennis.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Dennis Orme is a photographer whose new book is Seductions of Kauai, History Remembered. There's a book launch next Tuesday at the Kauai Museum in Lihue at 5:30, and it's free. You can find out more about the book on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
There's a place I recall, not too big, facts kind of small. The people there know they got it all. The simple life for me, Helio to Kauai, and the labor.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Bronster Fujichaku Robbins, a civil litigation law firm handling major cases on all islands for clients of all sizes, from individuals to Fortune 500 corporations. BFRHawaii.com.
This week on Invisibilia, we look at an incredible experiment that took place on an oil rig and how it changed the emotional lives of the men on board.
Had you ever talked this way emotionally with men?
No, that's just not a manly thing.
I'm Elise Spiegel. We are back with a brand new season of Invisibilia from NPR.
This evening at 7, following Counterspin.
Beth Ann, because it's in such a remote, to most of us, area of the globe, the current situation in the South China Sea is pretty much off the radar of most people, even those who regularly follow the news. But the RIMPAC exercise is kind of forcing us to think about that a little more, isn't it?
Which is why we talked a little bit this morning with Ralph Costa. And if you missed any of that, it'll be up on the archive. Give us about an hour or so, and you'll be able to listen to it again. But, you know, the idea of how much of this is, you know, inflammatory talk and trying to whip people into a frenzy, mm-hmm. and how much of it is really a concern. And as Ralph just came back from Beijing, it was interesting to talk to him and to hear some of what he had heard, which is, you know, everybody knows that we're there, but how much do we need to be there, and how much in your face are we asking our Navy to be? And that's what he says is the issue.
It's all part of the posturing of international affairs.
And too much of it. And understanding that that's the case. But no posturing here. We're going to come back with you tomorrow with some interesting response that we got to Hawaii Public Radio's and Civil Beats podcast series, Hawaii's New Ice Age. What about teens and crystal meth? According to the woman we'll talk to tomorrow, we need to be approaching teens differently. She's going to talk to us when we speak to her in the morning.
And a longtime backup singer, Lisa Fisher, moves to the front of the stage. We'd like to hear from you, and you can call us at our talkback line, which is 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation.
And again, if you've missed any of this program or you want to get another one, go look for it under The Conversation on the archive. It's right there at hawaiipublicradio.org.
I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you in the morning for more of The Conversation.